The Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council's Governance Committee meeting to order. Everyone has an agenda in front of them. So just looking at the agenda, the purpose of today's meeting is to go through a draft document that staff has put together for laying out our near-term plan of work between now and April, get some discussion, some suggestions. Ultimately, the goal is to adopt something with a recommendation to the Outdoor Heritage Council for their Monday meeting that can be considered by the full council. And hopefully, if we can get agreement here and get agreement on Monday, that will be our near-term plan of work for at least the next couple of months. So with that, I guess I'd like to have a motion to adopt the agenda.
So moved.
A motion to adopt the agenda. Any discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, we have an agenda. Second order of business, we have the minutes from our first governance committee meeting back on December 8th. I hope you've had a chance to take a look at that. Any discussion on the meeting minutes? Any comments? Any changes?
My only question is, since everything that we did was ultimately approved by the council, do we even have to approve the minutes?
I think we do.
Okay. Yeah. Then I move approval.
Okay. So we have a motion to approve the meeting minutes of December 8th. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? We have meeting minutes from December 8th. Great. So the purpose of today's meeting, again, is to go through the document that's before you. There are a couple of documents. The one that is titled Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council Strategy and Process for Developing 2009 Funding Recommendations, draft January 3rd, 2009. That's the document we're going to be working from. Dave has also put together some thoughts that are self-titled, six pages, Dave? And so at the appropriate time, you can kind of weave that in. But what I'd first like to do is have Bill go through the document that's before you. It's, five pages long? Just explain a little bit about the logic behind the document, what's in it, and then we can begin discussing it. So, Bill, you want to take it from here?
Thank you, Mike. The document titled The Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council Strategy and Process for Developing the 2009 Funding Recommendation is what I'm going through. It's in your packet. It begins with a preamble and contains five separate task areas. The preamble, which begins with background, basically says that the LHC needs to develop its recommendations by April the 1st. We will rely extensively on individual stakeholder input to identify priority conservation investment opportunities, and that the council will revise this process for future Outdoor Heritage Fund appropriation recommendations. The goal is to make recommendations to the legislature in a timely fashion, that is by April 1st, 2009. On appropriations of money from the Outdoor Heritage Fund that are consistent with the Minnesota Constitution and state law and supported by the legislature, governor, and the public. The document then goes on to describe the five-task process. The five tasks are to obtain background information on existing conservation plans and delivery systems, establish the framework for identifying priority conservation funding recommendations from the Outdoor Heritage Fund, obtain public input on priority conservation needs, and request stakeholders to identify 2009 conservation funding priorities, and finally to develop recommendations to the legislature. Task one, obtain background information, is basically a three-part task, beginning with statewide strategic comprehensive plans, followed by resource-specific or species-specific plan descriptions, and finally, a description of existing conservation delivery systems. Task two is divided into four areas. Basically, the principles to guide the Heritage Council process. And those principles are timely and we will employ a process that is timely, transparent to, and accessible by the public, protects and advances the public interest, provides opportunity for and considers public input, takes into account existing conservation planning efforts and delivery systems, encourages efficient and effective Conservation Solutions is understandable by the public and stakeholders. I want to just make a note that these items are items that came up in the brainstorming session at our last meeting and were recorded by staff. And we can get you the record of what was said if you're interested in that. I did not bring copies today, unfortunately. The minimum criteria for funding requests are the LOHC will only consider funding requests that are consistent with the uses of the Heritage Fund as specified in the Constitution, show the ability to produce significant, measurable, and enduring resource and or habitat outcomes, clearly identify specific resource and or habitat outcome performance measures, and a plan for measuring, evaluating, and publicly reporting these outcomes over time, have documented support of the affected local units of government, reflect the best available science regarding resource and or habitat enhancement, restoration, and protection, have a plan to sustain the resource and or habitat outcomes specified, including a plan to finance necessary activities, identify funding necessary to fully implement the project or program, identify property tax or in-lieu payment of tax consequences, and plan to deal with those consequences, limit the state's exposure for additional funding for the project, have a process for ensuring transparency and accessibility in all stages of project or program implementation, seek funding to supplement, not replace, customary or usual funding sources, only acquire permanent easements if proposing less than fee simple acquisition in real property, ensure that land acquired by fee with money from the Heritage Fund is open to the public, taking a fish game during the open season unless otherwise provided by law. The criteria of the requesting organizations. The council will only consider requests from organizations that have a public record of successful management and implementation of conservation projects or programs similar in scale, scope, and complexity to the project or program being requested, have demonstrated the ability to identify and establish the financial and managerial controls needed to successfully and fully implement the proposed program, and have an up-to-date external financial audit with no serious negative findings. Criteria for conservation priorities. The council will give priority consideration to requests that meet these five criteria. Produce multiple conservation benefits. Produce conservation benefits across a large geographic area. Are collaboratively developed by multiple stakeholders and interests. Have secured matching funds to supplement any Outdoor Heritage Fund appropriations, and address one-time opportunities that will be lost if not immediately funded. That is, there's a sense of urgency. Public input. Public input on priority conservation needs will be gained by encouraging stakeholders to conduct listening sessions in January of 2009, summarize the input they received in writing, and provide these summaries to the council by February. In addition, public input opportunities will be provided at each council meeting, full council meeting, I might add. Staff will develop a written summary of this input and provide this summary to the council members. The council will establish a website where public input is on conservation funding priorities and standard strategies can be provided. Item number four, request stakeholders to identify 2009 conservation funding priorities. The council will ask the state's conservation stakeholders to organize and convene open, inclusive, and collaborative processes to identify the highest priority conservation projects or programs and associated funding requirements in four areas: wetlands, prairies, forests, fish habitat. For each process associated with the four areas, the council requests a brief report describing participants in the process employed, long-term goals, important conservation issues, partners and partnerships involved, existing delivery systems and funding levels, as well as initiatives. And the highest, and we'll ask these stakeholders to provide the highest priority conservation projects or programs based on short and long-term funding requirements, anticipated habitat outcomes and associated timelines, measures of success and plans to monitor outcomes, level of local government support, and recommended delivery systems. Finally, the process and criteria used to identify the highest priority conservation projects or programs will be described. The fifth task is the council will develop recommendations to the legislature for appropriations. And based on the input above, the council will finalize recommendations to the legislature for appropriations from the Outdoor Heritage Fund to protect, enhance, and restore each of the following. And the four areas are listed. In addition, the council will also recommend an appropriation for the Outdoor Heritage Fund from the Conservation Partners Program. The geographic focus of the council's recommendation recognizes that there will be change in this process in the future and acknowledges that a geographic approach is probably superior. There are, on the page 4 at the end of the strategy, definitions of the four key verbs in the Constitution that describe what people can do with this money. And then there is a brief agenda taking us out through March, which basically has January as input on plans, programs, first at the statewide level, and then at the species area level. And also, in the second meeting in January, an investigation into existing conservation partners programs and a task to design a conservation partners program framework. The two meetings in Monday will be for presentations, first prairie, then wetland, followed by forests and fish and wildlife habitat. These are presentations by the stakeholders who we've encouraged to have these listening sessions and to organize. Monday, March 9th, we will finalize the funding recommendations. That has to be drafted into something that's acceptable to you. And so the second meeting in March, Monday the 23rd, will be for approval of the draft that will be presented to the legislature on April 1st. That is the plan developed collaboratively by the chair and staff.
Thank you, Bill. I think it's really important to recognize we have just six meetings, and that's six meetings every other week. To get our recommendations in place. So what's been laid out before you as a potential strategy really recognizes the time limits we're up against, but also that long-term our process will likely evolve into a lot of the things that we talked about at our previous meeting of the full council, but by necessity we just can't incorporate all of those things in the next less than 3 months, two months and 3 weeks. So with that, I guess I would like to entertain a motion to at least to get the discussion going to recommend adoption by the full council of this document, and then we can discuss it and make any changes we need. So a motion?
So moved.
We have a motion. Great. Thank you. So now we have this draft document for getting us to some recommendations by April 1, and I would just turn it open to folks. We can skin this cat a number of ways, but I think what we might want to do is, before we begin page by page, just get some comments from folks out on the table as you read this and you heard Bill, who did a really nice job summarizing what's in here. What are your thoughts? Are we on the right track? Do we need wholesale changes? Just give me your 30-second to 1-minute gut reaction to what Bill has described. Bill.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Could I have somebody just give me maybe just a brief definition of what... We look at from programs to projects. Projects, programs. What is the real difference? I mean, can somebody give me a real down-to-earth definition difference between the two?
Yeah, Bill?
I'll tell you how I feel about it.
Yeah, that's what I want.
And you can see if it resonates with the group. A project is generally, in my mind, a one-time, one-location request. It might be something like the restoration of Lake Christina. A program is a process over time to field projects, to evaluate them in terms of the benefits that they provide, and then to implement them. Programs, in my way of thinking about this, and as I wrote here, are a way of having over time sustained effort toward commonly agreed upon objectives and meritorious objectives, so that at the end of 5, 10, 15, or 25 years, there's a substantial change in the objective area that the program was directed toward. Projects are one-time appropriations for specific things in specific places. Is that generally what people are thinking about?
That's pretty consistent with my thought. Yeah, Ellen.
What, you know, the LCCMR has funded Habitat Corridors partnerships year after year. Would you consider that a program or a project?
I would consider that a program.
Other thoughts just about in general, what's out in front of you as a working draft? Ellen?
I think this is great. It's a really, it's pretty comprehensive. So my initial reaction is very positive. One thing that I apologize not reading this ahead of time. What do we say in here about, I wrote some things down about regional differences, and then I see that that's in here more specifically towards in the section about geographic focus, and that's really important. But the other piece is about making sure that we are addressing different parts of the state and not just focusing on one section of the state, and that we have geographic balance, which is necessary for a lot of reasons, scientific as well as political reasons. So is that really in is that goal reflected in the criteria anywhere? I didn't really see it, but maybe I missed it. So
let me address your comment, starting with the first one about the geographic distribution of the last. That is, in essence, a bit of kicking the can down the road. Mm-hmm. Recognizing we looked at trying to do this by province and that sort of thing. It became extraordinarily complex in terms of the number of areas you have to deal with. So I just wanted to clarify that before we go into that. And I think, and Mike, correct me if I'm wrong, you may have a better memory than I do, but on page 2, at the bottom of the page, in the criteria for identifying priorities, we're looking for benefits across a large geographic area. I don't think that hits the nail on the head as I understand what many of you are thinking about, which is contained, in fact, in, I believe, in David's comments, something to do with urban-rural balance.
Well, Mr. Chair, Bill, no, you're right, and I think large geographic area is an important concept in and of itself, but it doesn't really reflect that. And just to be honest, in the legislature, there's going to be people are going to be looking for geographic balance, and I'm not. That's not to say I want a project here and I want a project here. We're going to avoid that, hopefully at all costs. We're not going to be doing earmarking, but we're going to need to make sure that the benefit is broadly shared across the state, just as the funds are broadly collected across the state, and so we don't leave any particular geographic area behind.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah,
that's critically important.
Yeah, thank you. Liz.
Mike, I don't think this should be a requirement in the plan, because there are some years that we may concentrate on, an example, the Minnesota River Valley, and we may be only encompassing probably 3 or 4 or 5 counties if we were to get the project done. And if we say that we're going to spread these funds equally around the state, we probably want to inhibit some of the major projects. We may wind up spending $80 million in one particular segment of the state, and to restrict us from doing that, I think, would be a bad direction to go. So, yes, we will try for geographic distribution, but don't restrict that in case we have a major project that needs the most of the resources for that particular year.
Rick, did you have a comment?
I can just say, if you spend all the money in 2 or 3 counties, you're not going to get a bill passed.
Mr. Chair, I would just also add that I think the I think this part of this council's responsibilities is to determine what are the greatest threats, risks, and opportunities at any moment in time when we make some judgments, and those cannot be necessarily politically based, and I mean big P political based or geographically based, you know, for political purposes. I think we have to identify where we think, from a natural resource management standpoint, consistent with the Constitution, what those the biggest threats are and the biggest opportunities at that moment in time, and make our judgments at that point. And frankly, do the best we can to make our case to the legislature.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, just recalling back to our discussion we had in December about this, a lot of folks identified the need to have, over the long term, some ecologically based regional approach. Because I think I heard that from Les, I heard that from a number of folks, and I think everyone agreed that some element of that needs to be included. I think for the purposes of getting us to some recommendations in April 1, we're probably going to be a bit short of that. I mean, it may shake out that we get some regional-based priorities, but I think we're going to have time after April 1 to put together a more thoughtful process to figure out, first of all, what are the regions we're talking about and how do we engage conservation interests locally to do that. And given the time we have, we probably just can't do all of that between now and April 1. But I do recognize that that was a strong priority of the council, and it is for me as well. I'm just not sure we can practically implement it. Just a couple more kind of 30,000-foot level comments, and then we'll get to taking this probably section by section. So any other just overview comments? Wes and then Rick?
Go ahead. I'll defer.
Rick?
I think on just on items number 3 and 4, and maybe it's wordsmithing, but it gets to kind of a core question, and that's public use or public purpose. Another word for stakeholders, or two words, are special interests. So lobbying interests are, how does the public in general, are these public listening sessions, or are they only specific purpose listening sessions? Which gets to the core issue of who does the money belong to and how should it be spent. So I think in talking about public involvement, we have to put it as public listening sessions rather than specific stakeholder listening sessions. The stakeholders will be involved, and I think we were talking about having some listening sessions as of the council. And I think there needs to be some clarity. I know there's already been feedback from some of the listening sessions that have been occurring that really aren't connected with the council at all.
Right.
And feedback from the public saying, well, how come you're having listening sessions and not inviting me, thinking the council was having those listening sessions.
Right.
So public participation versus specific interest participation, I think we need to flesh that out a little bit.
That's a really good point, Rick, and just kind of in response to that, if you look back at that last page, I know that John is here from the Board of Water and Soil Resources. John was here. John Jasky. Anyway, I know they've organized back in December and November a series of 7 regional listening sessions just to get input about what are some of the pressing conservation needs and priorities. And the intent, I believe, Bill, is to have John, as the Executive Director of the Board of Water and Soil Resources, present a summary of those listening sessions to the council on Monday so we can start getting a sense of, you know, short of the 12 of us going out to Windham and to Bemidji and whatever, what folks are saying around the state. But we need a lot, you know, we need lots of that. Les, yeah.
Starting at item 1, I don't know how many people have thoroughly read through the 2 main plans that I've looked through as a 50-year vision. Minnesota Conservation Preservation Plan. I think we're stretching our definition when we call this a plan versus possibly an overall philosophy and a strategy. Because if you look at the 50-year vision, you'd see, I don't disagree with anything in the document. It's a great vision. But to summarize the document, all we have to do is control inappropriate development and change ag policy, which are two monstrous situations that I don't think this council or anybody else is going to do in the next 3 or 4 years. So, look, yeah, and I don't disagree with the plans, as we call them, but the philosophy versus implementation, there's a long, long, great gap in between those. And I think we have to look at them accordingly. I went through the Minnesota Conservation Preservation Plan, and we have representation here from Ms. Coleman, and it's a very detailed plan. It's a lot of great ideas, but again, to go from that particular conceptual document down to an implementation strategy, I think we have to really look at that that gap. And one of the ones that's missing very, very conspicuously is the duck recovery plan, which is not in here. That really is a plan of identifying hard, true objectives and how do we accomplish those. So I think we have to really look at the background information. And, yes, we have to look at this, but how do we implement that? That's really going to be our major challenge.
Yeah, good point, Les. In fact, just in response to that, if you look on that same number 1, In addition to these, what we'll call statewide strategic conservation plans, the kind that you know you held up, we plan to devote a lot of time in January to getting a background on some of the resource-specific plans, like wetlands restoration plans or species-specific plans or WMA acquisition plans, to get some of the detailed plans and goals that are in place before the council, as well as how we deliver conservation. So all of that is really under the rubric of background information to get us a better understanding of what the plans are and how we deliver conservation. Dave, and then I think we'll probably, after this, unless there are any burning comments, we'll start going through this document and see if we can't get some agreement. Dave?
One of the things I noticed, and maybe I just don't have enough background, but the background information piece that I didn't really see in here is what existing grant programs exist in the state that we might decide could do the work for us to some degree instead of us having to make every decision. Are there folks running programs that we could provide money to with specific direction to carry out the work that we want to do and not duplicate what they're capable and already in business doing? And I'd love to add that to the list of background.
That's a great idea. The intent, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Bill, was when we talk about conservation delivery, that's one element of it, is who's doing what out there in terms of acquisition as well as management.
See, but I think I'm talking about a different level. I'm talking about some state agency that's running a program that allocates money to every county for restoration to people who apply to that, and instead of us having to listen to all of those folks, someone who could...
I think we're on the same page.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Mr. Chair, to that point, David, I think we kind of cover that here and have a public record of successful management and implementation conservation program, projects slash programs, page 2, first bullet under criteria for requesting organizations. I agree with what you've said, and I see that there's generally, if not specifically, acknowledgement to the maturity of an existing program or enterprise that can do what we hope not have to do ourselves.
I think it's in the edges. I think hopefully if we make it explicit that that's what we're looking for,
that's
we
won't get suggested.
That's my only issue.
The only caution I would make is that you're sounding a lot like supplanting in your language that you're using, so we just need to be really cautious that we're not talking about funding what existing programs are doing. So this would be above and beyond. So, I mean, that's going to be something we have to always be
aware of. Absolutely.
Okay, any other burning? Bob, did you have a last?
Sorry, just one last point.
Yeah.
On this. I think we also want to be mindful of the fact that there is development opportunities yet to be seen 2 years, 3 years, 5 years out for local enterprises that don't exist today that see an opportunity through a funding source that comes from the council that allows groups of individuals to get together, create organizations, petition us. And I think we maybe have some acknowledgement of an opportunity. I know that will come through the grants program that we make development.
Yeah, good, very good point. I guess what I'd propose is that we just go through this document, and we'll go through it section by section and see if what type of changes, if any, we need to make, get some agreement on that, and hopefully at the end we can then support the adoption of this for the full council's consideration on Monday. So with that, I guess starting out with the beginning, the first part is the background and the goal. Are there any comments? Darby?
Well, yeah, I by and large think this is a great starting point document, but what I had hoped was that at some point we would have a strategic plan that laid out where this all goes. And I realize we're under incredible time pressure. And the fact that there's no reference to it, does that simply mean because of time pressure we can't do that right now, but after this first round has happened, then we will actually do that before we go any farther? I mean, the strategic plan is a roadmap, and what we're really saying is we're going to start running down this road without necessarily that overriding map. And I do have some concerns about the absence of that, although I'm certainly willing to say, okay, clearly the time issue is very significant. Let's just hold on that. We'll get some input from the public, and maybe that will inform ultimately the nature or pieces of the strategic plan. That's one concern that I had. And the other one really in that same background section is, and I guess I'd address this to the legislators, It says we're to make recommendations by April 1. Does that take into account moving through committees and so forth? I mean, it seems to me that maybe we need to back that up earlier. If that's, you know, what do you folks have to say?
Well, Mr. Chair,
yeah, Ellen.
Darby, the way I've been thinking about this is that I think there'd be a lot of advantage for us to do a separate legacy bill I think it needs to be separated from our regular budget bill. And I haven't talked to Representative Murphy in the House about this yet, about what her intentions are in her committee, but it just seems to me that we're going to be in a much better position to protect this money from being mushed together with the regular budget and budget cuts if we do it separately. And so this timeline is actually kind of advantageous in that regard, because it gives us a pretty good reason to do our bill in April rather than whenever we're doing the regular budget. And normally we'd be done, you know, this would be after our regular budget has gotten through my division and onward to finance, the full finance committee. But it's a little hard to, I don't really know what those deadlines, we don't know what our deadlines are yet. So I don't know if it would be before or after, and yes, it would have to go through the regular committee process.
Well, I guess the related question then is, how many different committees do you anticipate it's going to have to pass through?
That's a very good question, and I don't, Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer. I don't know if you've had more discussion about this in the House, but I'm envisioning, and I'm hoping everyone will agree, that, you know, it's going to have to go through the different divisions, certainly, not necessarily policy committees, but, you know, the Ag Division and the, it depends. The answer is I don't know, and it depends, and we'll see. I mean, the water piece I know has pieces in the ag budget, in the deed, economic development budget, as well as in my environment budget. The habitat portion is pretty much in the environment budget, but there could be pieces in other budget divisions that we want to look at, but I think it needs to all end up in one. So I think it should just be heard in finance committee divisions, which would limit the number of committees.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
I think if we worry about what the internal happenings that are going on in the House and the Senate, we're going to get wrapped around the axle. We're going to present a bill by the 1st of April, and if we don't get funding established on projects in the field, we're going to have the wrath and ire of about 2 million people in the state of Minnesota of not getting the job done. So we're going to let the legislature do the job, and I don't think we can get too far into the internals of the problems that you're going to have. Let's get the bill to the legislature by the 1st of April as a standalone one, and then we'll sit back and wait for you to perform.
There's pressure.
Let's go. All right.
Let's go. Okay.
Bill,
just a comment and follow up with Ellen was talking about it. Senator, you envision like a big omnibus bill.
I don't know. I think
separate all by itself with many different sections in it. Yeah, that's kind of how I envision it.
Yeah, I mean, we may start.
A separate bill that addresses how the funding from the constitutional amendment, both arts, water, parks,
square,
is all used together.
Yeah, I don't know if the arts money will be part of it. That might be separate. But it makes sense to have the legacy money treated separately. So I guess I haven't talked with Senator Cohen, the finance chair, to get his read on, but I think that's the best way to go.
Yeah. Rick?
I think
in the end.
Yeah. I think Les brings up a good point. And the only thing I would look at is more the calendar to your original question, Darby, is that if we look at traditionally when there have been deadlines, they're usually around the Passover Easter break, which is around April 1st, probably end of March. So there may need to be, I mean, so if it comes after the deadline, then you have to have the Rules Committee doing that. I think obviously because of the high profile, that may occur, but I haven't had any communication relating to that. But just generally, I think we should think about that this April 1st is about the time that there would be, there's usually a break in there and deadlines anyway, so the sooner we get our work done, the better.
Yeah, make a suggestion. Monitor the deadline process and make sure we meet the deadline.
Okay. So, Bill, did you recapture the essence, particularly, I think Darby had a specific suggestion for that introductory paragraph. Do you have any general theme that we could the members of this committee could hear, and if they some nods of the head, then we can say, yep, is that sufficient? We can move on.
Well, I'm sorry, I just would say that I agree with Darby's point about the strategic plan. We talked about it in our first meeting. I don't think anybody here disagrees with
okay,
that.
Okay, so
the way I see it is the distinction is, though, we are under time pressure, I think. I'd say, Darby, right now we have a traditional map. In the future, we hope to have one that's GPS and satellite-backed.
All right. Well, we have a compass.
And
we do have a compass.
That's all the Constitution.
We aren't totally lost.
I have two sentences that the committee may want to insert to commit the council to Darby's idea, and they would come at the end of the background paragraph. And the two sentences would read, the LOHC recognizes the need for a strategic plan for the Outdoor Heritage Funds. In 2009, the LOHC will rely on existing strategic plans. By 2010, the LOHC will develop a strategic plan specifically for Outdoor Heritage Fund efforts.
That works for me.
Sure.
Yeah, okay. Great. We can move on then. We've got a goal statement there right below that first paragraph. Any comments? Everything? Everyone okay with that? Okay. So really, the guts of this proposal is laid out in the next couple of pages, which is a five-step process about how we plan to conduct our work. The first one is obtaining this background information. Les and others have alluded to getting the council up to speed, understanding what plans exist, both strategic, high level, as well as resource, species, specific plans, as well as how we deliver conservation and who's involved in that. If that's not clear enough, or we need to do something in addition. What? Any changes to number one or any thoughts? I think if we have some general themes, Bill can try to wordsmith it and read back to us some proposed language. Dave?
I'd just like to add to point three, existing conservation delivery systems and grant programs. Just make it explicit that we...
That's a good suggestion. I like it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Could you repeat that, please?
Existing conservation delivery system descriptions and grant programs.
Okay. Thank you.
Other suggestions on number one? So that by the end, the intent was that by the end of January, we're really going to be on a steep learning curve, but we'll be a little higher up on that curve than we all are now. Okay. All right. So the number two then is, we had talked a lot about this at our meeting on December 17th of some of the principles that we would like to see embody this whole process, as well as some criteria. So what Bill's captured are a number of these principles and criteria. Let's take them one at a time. Principles to guide the Outdoor Heritage Council process, and there are six of those enumerated. Any thoughts on those, suggested changes, deletions, whatever? Ellen?
Well, I was writing one, a new one.
Okay.
And we had an interesting discussion just in the last few minutes about the issue of geographic balance and about the need. Some of us were concerned about statewide benefits. Some of us were concerned. Other concerns that were raised were being sure that we're nimble and that we can respond to pressing concerns and priorities. And obviously, good conservation principles need to override all of that. And so I'm trying to write a sentence that captures all of that and sort of at least balances those ideas to say that they're all important and that one doesn't override the other. Because I agree that those are all important. And so here's what I wrote. I don't know if it's that great, but ensures conservation benefits are broadly distributed around the state, consistent with conservation principles and the need to focus on priorities. But that's a first stab at that idea, and maybe we could...
I'm seeing some nods of the head saying that sounds...
Okay,
yeah,
that would make me
comfortable.
Yeah,
I think you put it at the end there, strategic plan.
And strategic plan, very good.
I don't want to go too fast for you, Bill, but did you capture the essence of that?
I
can show you what I have.
Okay.
That's yours.
Okay.
On the bottom.
Okay. Other comments? Dave?
Because I don't have it in front of me, I'm just thinking it through and trying to remember. But I think it's important to be nimble enough that if there's an opportunity this year or in future years to put a disproportionate amount of money to work in a specific place because it won't be there tomorrow or next year, that we have a willingness to consider that and don't box ourselves in and say, no, we said we'd be broad and everybody'd be treated equal, and there are always going to be places where the opportunity is better. And so I'm hopeful that, Bill, maybe you can think about that as you're doing this and just make sure that the essence of that, which I think nobody is going to really disagree with, is captured in what Ellen wrote, and I don't remember verbatim.
Okay, Les? Chairman, if I could support your concept, David, where an example would be maybe a two-county area, St. Louis County and Kuching, where we've got the Forest Legacy opportunity and problem. Now, granted, this may only encompass two counties, but it's going to be the benefit of all the people in the state of Minnesota, and I think we have to leave this flexibility, and I support that concept where there is times where there is not going to be equal geographical distribution for the benefit of the people of the state. So I think we have to leave that flexibility open.
Over the long term, it probably will balance yes. out, but in any individual year, there will be unbalanced, but I don't think we can ignore geographic diversity, because I agree with Rick and Ellen. It isn't going to get through the legislature if all the money goes to southeastern Minnesota, even if it's a great project.
Yeah, or similarly, all the money goes to fish habitat or prairie restoration, whatever that might be. Yeah. Darby.
I just piggyback on what David's brought up, but we may want to at some point consider setting aside an emergency fund. It's just there, ready to go. When something pops up that it's once, you know, it's going to be there for a month or a year or whatever.
Yeah. Well, to that point, Mr. Bob. Chair, do you mind just, you and I have talked offline about this, your concept on that particular notion about how the council might operate.
Yeah.
Do you want to just quickly describe that?
Well, you know, so we've got, you know, if you look at the three verbs, protect, restore, and enhance, and we really have four areas. We have fish, well, forests, prairies, wetlands, and then fish habitat, kind of to the fish resource. But then we also have some money we need to set aside for the Conservation Partners Program. But in it, so we're going to make some allocations, and the question is, and I think we're going to need to talk about this today as well as Monday, do we want to throw something out there, or what is drafted here is to, let's listen to what the priorities are and then make some decisions. But part of that asset allocation model might be setting aside some money in a reserve account that we can do just what you're describing, Darby. So if there's these one-time opportunities that are now or lost, we don't have to wait till the next recommendation cycle, which could be 12 months, 11 months, to deal with that issue. Yeah, is that what you were thinking, Bob?
Yeah, Rick?
I think I was going to bring up the reserve idea from just a fiscal management of it, because we may not know what the economy is going to do. So if we make recommendations for $80 million and we have $70 million come in, you know, that we may want to hold a reserve or a cash flow portion of this, particularly in FY09, that could be used but maybe be considered for the next year's appropriation until we get some idea of how the economy is going in. And then I think the other, and this could be a bullet just about having some type of fiscal reserve or that we don't appropriate all of the funds because we don't know what we're going to get, and that I think we want to make sure to show to Minnesotans that we're being wise with the money, that we don't hand the money out and then all of a sudden, oops, we didn't have enough money there. So, and that may mean staging some of the distribution on projects throughout the year. So some type of a fiscal piece, I think, is important. I think the other thing we may want to take just a look at is this issue that's been brought up before about bonding and revenue bonding. And I think that ties into the fiscal fiscal piece of this, and maybe that's a way to have some of the reserve. But I think one of the bullets when we talk about appropriations is just having some sound fiscal management, and I say that after getting the $5 billion shortfall, that we want to make sure we have a little bit of a cushion there.
So for example, on skipping ahead, just to look ahead to number 5 on page 3, I just put a note to myself where we talk about developing recommendations in each of those four resource areas, fish, forest, prairies, and wetlands, and a conservation partners program. I put a note in your a reserve account for those purposes. Ellen?
Well, we might want to think about the idea of an emerging issues account or something like that, which is or more like the model that the LCCMR uses, although we've had it on a very small scale, and it's a small amount of money compared to our overall budget.
Right.
but that money is appropriated. And, you know, the legislature is going to be reluctant to appropriate a large amount of money, you know, 10 or 20% of our budget, mm-hmm. and without it knowing where it's going to go. But perhaps so that's the only restriction. But the nice thing about it is that once it's appropriated, then, you know, the LCCMR can spend that money. We have to get the approval of the governor to sign off, but it's already appropriated, and so it doesn't have to wait for the legislative process. It's available for urgent items, and right now we're trying to use the account that we have to fund a Bowser proposal, which would really help us prioritize conservation reserve and lands and hopefully that will be a benefit to us as a council and to some of the other work that's being done with the legacy money.
Yeah, okay. Bill, did you have something?
Yeah, in an earlier iteration, we took the reserve idea into account, and I'm going to read to you what we...
Mr. Chair, I want to be sure we have our terminology correct. Rick was talking about reserve, I believe, in the sense of let's not spend all $80 million.
Right.
I've also heard the term reserve meaning as an emerging issues account type definition, mm-hmm. so I think I'd like to get our terminology correct. Mm-hmm. I don't really care what it is as long as it's understood.
I like that emerging issues account. I think that better reflects the opportunity that we're trying to capture.
Well, Mr. Chair, we may want to have both. They're sort of different
purposes.
Both. Yes.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Yes.
But the distinction
but they're
is...
They're two different names
correct.
And
definition.
Different
yes.
definitions.
Yes.
Yes.
Yep. Okay. Bill?
Let me give this a try. This was written on December 20th prior to your advice. And we'll try to incorporate
it. A year ago.
The council anticipates the Outdoor Heritage Fund income of $78 million in state fiscal year 2010. The fund must finance its own cash flow. To address cash flow needs and to cushion against a downturn in sales tax receipts, the council recommends appropriating the first X million in receipts, less administrative funds, into a newly created cash flow and a newly created emerging issues account within the fund. The remaining, we can figure to the math, is available for recommendation to programs.
So that's, Mr. Chair, that's appropriated.
No. Yes.
I thought the reserve was not appropriated. It was just held back. And we just had a bill. We proposed the legislature approved less than the full amount. So that's two very different ideas.
I think we need to think about whether or not we want to leave unappropriated money in the account.
In the fund.
Or in the fund, excuse me. Or whether we want to create an account within the fund that's specifically for purposes such as cash flow and emergency. Nothing is perfect, but it's a little higher hurdle to get over.
Any other thoughts? This is a really good discussion. Any other thoughts on the principles? I like, and Bill's got some language for what we've been talking about. To address Darby, your concern, Ellen, you had a suggestion. Anything else?
Mr. Chair,
yeah,
if we look at unappropriate monies and we decide that we've got an opportunity in the March timeframe after session, by the time we get through the bill in the following year, that opportunity is long gone. So we have to look at some nimbleness as far as our ability to operate and move when the opportunity arises, too.
Mm-hmm.
I think the struggle is going to be the legislature not wanting to just leave money for us to, by ourselves, decide to spend. And when those emergency opportunities come up, it's never about a little bit of money. You know, setting aside a couple $100,000 isn't going to solve the opportunity that you and I would think about in terms of need to jump on something quickly. And I think we're going to have to deal with the reality that unfortunately creating this, you know, sort of well-intentioned fund that the legislature will just give a blessing to us to spend when it's appropriate is really going to be a struggle.
Well, I think the safeguard to that might be that language is written that creates allows the money to be put into an account, if you will, and a recommendation of the council under an off-year or off-legislative session to the LAC for final approval or something along those lines.
Yeah, I mean, you can do it with the right safeguards, but you've got to be very...
Oh, yeah, absolutely right.
Les?
Well, looking at it from a pure business standpoint, let's not tie our hands too
tightly as far as our ability to operate and react also. So let's figure a way to do that. And I would recommend, you know, a reserve of 10%. Possibly this is going to change. It's going to vary as we get into year 2, 3, and 4. And as the legislature becomes more comfortable with it, I think we have to have that flexibility and opportunity to make those decisions. Otherwise, we get bound by a very restrictive, physical bound that's not going to work. So let's figure out a way to do that.
Okay. Let's. I think we've exhausted the principles piece pretty well. Let's go to page 2. Yeah, and I exhausted the members as well. So minimum criteria. So the top of page 2 talks about the LOHC will only consider funding requests that, and there are a number of bullets. Comments on those bullets? So this would be the minimum standards, we'll call them, for any funding. So Ellen and then Darby.
I wanted to talk about bullet number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Have a plan to sustain the resource and or outcomes specified, including a plan to finance. Is that talking about monitoring easements, for example? You know, how do we maintain oversight over a long-term obligation? Because that needs to be part of it.
That's that, as well as the restoration activities as well. So I think it's not only the administrative side, but also the resource management side. So it's one thing to fund a project to restore wetland, but what about the maintenance to make sure that wetland is restored to the quality we want it?
Mm-hmm.
So yes, the answer is inclusive. Sure. Bob?
You know, David, I think you're trying to, I'm keeping mindful of your comments here because we're about to get into them, and I think this might be one of them.
Yeah, well, clearly with conservation easements, there is a perpetual obligation to both ensure compliance with that easement, and if necessary, then take action to enforce compliance with the easement. And the land trust community does that by setting aside money into permanent funds that is there to draw upon both for annual monitoring activity and long-term enforcement actions. And I think, you know, to the degree we partner with nonprofit organizations, we should be requiring that and requiring it at an appropriate level. And I will say from my experience nationally, there are some organizations that think if you put $500 in the bank, you have enough money to do the job. And I'm telling you, you don't. So it's got to be reasonable. In the case of government, we're going to have to be a little more creative in figuring out how you create permanent funds that can't be rated. But I think we should be committed to funding that long-term obligation so that we're not, frankly, doing what some agencies in the state have done in the past, which is protect land with conservation easements and then woken up 20 years later to realize they've never looked at it and they have no idea if it's protected.
Les?
Mr. Chairman, I would have a little bit disagreement with your approach, David. Looking at how an easement is formed, I think it's very important. Once the easement is established, the easement is registered on the abstract or the title, and once that's on the title or the abstract, it's very difficult to remove. With the Soil and Water Conservation District, the easement, they take care of the registration of that easement, and that becomes a titled issue. The maintenance and monitoring of that is part of the function of SWCD as far as inspecting that on a yearly basis to go through and look at the invasive species, the cover, all the things that that easement was established to protect. I've got a couple of examples. I'll make some examples available at the next meeting of annual inspection reports where it's very detailed. The monies there fall into the soil and conservation districts under the jurisdiction of the counties and Bowser. These monies are part of their internal budget, and granted, there are some exceptions where some of these easements have been broken, but remember that when we're putting land aside, the best thing that we can do in some of these easements is leave it alone.
Mm-hmm.
Inspect it for the invasive species, excuse me. So inspect it for the invasive species, and if you look at the cycle and flow of this, we generally have the construction season in that March, April, May, June 15th. We cut off the native prairie seedings. We go into the monitoring, and that's when that department has the money and the time and the personnel to go through and inspect these easements, perform the report back, and if there's a violation, they take that up with the local sources and the state level to make sure that that easement is enforced. And I think it's a working system, and yes, we do have some minor instances that this will be violated, but let's take care of the entire picture rather than trying to govern the exceptions.
But I don't think you're understanding my point. My point is that what you're talking about has to take place. The problem is it isn't funded.
When
Bowser takes an easement, their obligation to go out and monitor it annually and then to enforce it if it's violated comes out of their annual budget. If that budget is cut at the legislature, there's no way that they have the ability to do that. Bowser is now, in some cases, monitoring easements every 5 years because they don't have the resources in place to go out every year and do it. And what I'm suggesting is that money be set aside in a fund to ensure that there are resources available every year to do that, so that as different organizations or agencies take on additional obligations of conservation easements, that they also have the resources that we provide them, the long-term resources, to be able to do the work that they're committing they want to do, but ultimately might not be there if their budgets are cut.
Well, having had the opportunity working with the Land Trust and Bowser, if Bowser doesn't have the money to enforce, then doesn't it become our obligation to present this to the state and make sure that that budget, and if we need to, create a certain percentage of that for administrative and follow-on maintenance of that account?
Well,
rather than creating, again, two parallel bureaucracies doing the same thing.
I'm not creating a parallel bureaucracy or suggesting it. I'm suggesting we create a long-term funding source for the folks that are in place today doing the work.
Yeah, and I'd just like to bring this back to this document, which the whole intent is to, for that bullet number six, is to whatever comes before us as a minimum criteria, yeah, there is some plan about the long-term activity, be they monitoring or restoration, and a financing plan that goes with it. So the question before this committee is that language appropriate, or should we change that to clarify the intent of, or strike it altogether? Are you comfortable with it the way it is?
Which specific bullet are you?
This is the bullet, last number's bullet. It's not enumerated, but the sixth bullet down.
Okay, yeah.
So have a plan to sustain the resource and or habitat outcomes.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Les.
In conjunction to David, we have parallel situations that exist. We have the individual that's putting their land into the land trust. This is definitely going to be under the monitoring of the land trust. Then we also have easements that will be under the control of Bowser and the Bureau of Water, or the SWCD. And I think we have two different situations here, and I don't think we can take the easements that are under SWCD and move those into the land trust.
No, I'm not suggesting
That's what I'm listening to.
I'm suggesting that we figure out how to fund the long-term maintenance and enforcement of the terms of the easement by whomever is doing it, that we just figure out and make sure that there are funds available that takes place.
Yeah, and in fact, this bullet says these people requesting either a program or a project need to lay out that plan. Not us, but they need to come to us with a plan in place that says beyond the restoration of this wetland or the ease of these forests, that we have a plan to monitor to make sure that the forest, the wetlands are restored, the forests are perpetuated, and so forth. That's what this bullet is trying to say.
Mr. Chair, I think we need that bullet. No matter how we solve that problem and how we organize it, it's going to be a multiple of things. And I don't disagree with you. It's just a matter of how we're going to arrive at the end result.
Okay. Any other comments or comments on this section? Dave?
I'm concerned with the need to have documented support of the affected local units of government. And I know where this comes from, which is about taking land off the tax rolls. But I don't know if we're doing a restoration project if we need the county to sign off and say that prairie restoration is okay. I don't know if we're doing a conservation easement that we need to do that. I don't think in all cases that there is conflict there that needs to be resolved by an added level of bureaucracy.
I was thinking about that where appropriate.
Yeah, I think that's
appropriate because there are conditions when you perform an easement where you're going to cross over lines in the especially in the watersheds area where you may not be aware of it and all of a sudden you get into it and shoreline management is out there saying stop the project because you've violated the shoreline impact zone or something like that. So I think that as a reference point, and if there is any suggestion or question of it, I think we need that local approval. It's very, very important.
I like that suggestion to qualify where appropriate that these approvals are needed.
Mr. Chair, my view is this is a checklist.
It is our checklist.
It's a checklist.
That's right.
And, you know, we're going to, every one of these people in this audience, the folks that come before us, we're going to say,
if we don't have these
what's
satisfied, we're not
that's
bringing
that's right. Yeah. Have you got the county commission's sign on?
Right.
Yep.
Darby?
Mr. Chair?
Excuse me, Darby? Let me my comment is really kind of general, and it goes to the notion that this whole page 2 really almost becomes the equivalent of an RFP. I mean, that's what we're going to make available to the general public so that when they apply, they know ahead of time what it is we're going to be looking for. And, you know, I think as written, it does good service to that. But I'll tell you, I really got sensitized. I was able to visit to attend the Bowser's St. Paul listening session. And the issue of the LCCMR's sort of RFP and the response of others, and there were people, the guy sitting next to me and somebody else, both said, I will never again apply for an LCCMR grant. It is too much work. It is complicated, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it was suggested that there were some other RFPs out there that modeled things a little bit more user-friendly. And all I'm really concerned about is as we shift this material into the form that we're going to go to the public, we've obviously got to do the stuff that's on this list, but we really want to do our best to make it as simple as we can to make sure that people really don't get turned off. That really hurt me when I heard those comments about LCCMR.
Yeah,
I mean,
just looking
there are people out there that are saying, the hell with them, you know?
On that point, that very point, looking back to page 1, principles, I'm not sure if we fully captured your point, but... So there's some principles, some guiding principles for this process, and you know it's timely, transparent, and accessible. It's easy to understand. It's understandable by the public and stakeholders. Maybe that's not enough, but I think that was the intent to get at your point.
But it's not overly cumbersome. It became really sort of formidable when I look. You know, we got a lot of stuff on page 2 that I think is really important stuff. So it's going to be a difficult task, and I think we need to be sensitive.
Yep.
That's all.
Les, and then Rick.
I lost my train of thought. Go ahead.
Okay, Rick.
I think Darby brings up a good point that, and again, with the deadline of us having to get something by April 1st, how on earth is anyone going to get a proposal written that includes, I count, at least 3 plans plus a documentation of local government support, and then which includes a tax analysis? It's not going to happen in 3 months.
Yeah. I apologize for this document being late. I was working at the late hours. It's a brief summary, and I don't think we have to do a lot of these things because they're already done in many cases. And if I could get our administrator to just hand these out, I would appreciate
it. Can you describe what it is? Just for the people in the audience?
Put the excess up there that they can see. It's basically looking at geographical organization, looking at how the state agencies of SWCD and Bowser would work together as a focal source with the policies and procedures in place in most of the cases. In some of these cases, they won't be an active part. If a private landowner goes through the Minnesota Land Trust or something like that, they won't be playing an important part. But a lot of these procedures are in place. The SWCD operates as a focal point with the major organizations, the DNR, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service,
NRCS, Deer Hunters Association, and the small clubs that do not have the capability of doing this on an individual basis. If we ask the small clubs to do what we're asking would do in the criteria for requesting, we've eliminated 95% of the stakeholders in the state of Minnesota. Now we can use an organization that's in place, and I have disagreed with them on numerous occasions, but we've always got the job done. SWCD is operational. It interfaces with the county at the local level, and it interfaces with the state at the state level. I think it's a very effective organization, a central point, a focal point that has the administration, the design, the monitoring criteria all established, and we need to use these people. And if there's problems in it, then we can make some changes and adjustments to the procedure. So I think we need to start continue the discussion with Bowser, because there are some real underlying problems that Bowser has identified we are going to be faced with as we proceed also.
Great. Thanks for sharing that, Les. Any other comments on this checklist, the minimum criteria? Are we okay to move on?
I'm sorry. Rick, will you finish it?
Oh, Rick.
I was going to come back to item number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, the property tax, in-lieu payment of tax consequences. And I both in the short term and the long term, you know, it's going to be very difficult for a requesting entity to know this. Just to prepare for it. And I'll just state my own opinion. I think when people are voting for this, they weren't thinking of payment in lieu of taxes as being a use of the fund. So I guess I'd like some clarification if the thought here is that the fund, LOHC fund, would, you know, that they're identifying the amount of in lieu of taxes for the project that would have to come from the fund, or is this saying that there is going to be a loss? You know, this is, I'm assuming, for fee title acquisition, but I just sense a great, that's a big bullet there. That's
well,
22.
Yeah, so my interpretation of that bullet was simply, you know, raising the recognition that there are some tails to a project where you either acquire fee simple or less than fee simple ownership some rights, and it's not. I never interpreted this bullet as being that the Outdoor Heritage Fund would be the funder of those tails, but that simply when a deal comes before that, it's recognized that there is going to be some loss or shifts in property tax revenue. And you know, maybe a way to do this is to delete everything after the word consequences, simply just to identify what those consequences are. Because they may not be able to have a plan in place to deal with them, but simply raise them as part of their proposal.
Well, Mr. Chair, to that point, if we are going to make a statement that there is a plan in place to deal with the tax consequences, however that may be, payment in lieu of taxes or directly payment of taxes, and we also know that the funding source runs out in 20, almost 25 years.
Yeah.
And we're going to have perpetual easements. Perpetual means 26, 27, 28, year 29, year 1,000. Tax obligation that goes with it. There's some contradictions there.
Yep.
And obviously, we're not going to be able to commit to fund in years 26 and beyond. And so we have to have some acknowledgement that it exists and that there's a plan in place to deal with it. And I think in an ideal circumstance, that it's not the obligation of the Outdoor Heritage Fund to take that.
So, Bob, are you saying you're comfortable with that plan in place being left in or taken out?
I'm fine with it being in.
Mr. Chair,
Les?
This is going to be one of the snaky ones that's going to come up time and time again, especially at the local government level. The FILT payment is a major, major concern around the state of Minnesota. The primary reason, because of the responsibility where it lies with the DNR. The local government units would like that taxation assessment authority at the county level and not at the state level. There is going to be a tax obligation no matter where it's existing. If it's at the state level, we're going to have to pay it at the state level out of general funds or somewhere. Or if it's at the county level, we're going to have to figure some kind of a reserve fund or a long-term fund to satisfy that obligation.
But pillar payments are a major, major burr under the saddle of the local units of government, and that one is going to have to be addressed and solved by our legislatures.
So getting back to this point, eight, other folks, now Bob, you're comfortable leaving it as is. What are other folks?
I would think that it, the burden of having a plan, I think of what we're going through in the next 2 months, figuring out how to come up with a plan is just not going to happen. I think identifying the consequences would be fine. We're going to ultimately have to make decisions without firm plans in place. Because I don't think anybody can do it, and I think we create that burden so high nobody can apply.
Yeah. Well, I think there are probably some organizations that have been around for a long time that deal with the issue of taxes, and they've figured out
sure.
some method that works. But maybe you're right that it's maybe it's a consideration on our part that they have a plan. Maybe it's an added benefit that they do, but in 2 months it may not be something that is legitimate for others.
I'd like to just start with just what are the consequences.
Okay, so I'm here and put a period after the word consequences just so that that's highlighted, identified in any proposal. Other things on this section about these minimum criteria or the checklist, as Bob said. Yeah, Rick?
I'm thinking about back to the statute and the small conservation partners mm-hmm. matching grants. And mm-hmm. say someone's applying for $5,000 to match a $5,000 raised at a banquet that's going to be used for reseeding a public area or whatever. And so do they go through this whole thing? Or I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think you've got to, if we're going to have the conservation, maybe we define that this is for, we have to, I think we're charged with recommending a procedure for the conservation partners.
Yes.
Saying, and that this is really not that little $5,000 or $1,000 grant or thing. This is something a little more.
That's a very good point, Rick. I think we need to clarify that this is really for the fish habitat, forest, prairies, and wildlife, the big chunks of money, the Conservation Partners Program. We're going to be working to develop that over the ensuing months, and I think those criteria might be somewhat to largely different depending on, you know, because of the order of magnitude of what we're talking about.
Chair, on that point, I view this document as it says in our goals, to make recommendations for April 1st, 2009, the Conservation Partners Program will be something that will begin to take shape
right.
after that point.
Right. So can we, Bill, do you have any thoughts? Well, you don't have to read it back, but just clarify that this really deals with the big fish, forest, prairies, wetland piece, not the Conservation Partners Program per se. It could be that a number of them are included, but I don't want to presuppose that. Any other? Dave?
You know, I'm not sure where to put it, but one of the things that has sort of passed through my mind, and I certainly wrote in my stuff, is we're going to get situations where we fund activities for acquisition of either fee or easement, and over time, the ownership of that easement or fee is going to be more appropriately placed someplace different than where it starts out. And I think it's maybe not in the criteria for funding requests, but we do need to stick in somewhere that you can't just transfer out the interest that we have allowed an organization or an agency to acquire, that there has to be an approval process. And I don't see where else to put it but in here that someone would agree to come back and do that. But I'm not stuck on it being here, but somewhere we need to establish that if Bowser buys a piece of land and the DNR is a better holder and manager of the land, that they can't just do that. That there's some level of process that involves it, and those aren't the two agencies that make the most sense. I've certainly been involved in small land trusts who just decide they don't want to maintain an easement anymore, and so they're going to, you know, extinguish it.
Yeah, I'm seeing some nods of the head. Yeah, that makes sense. Dave, can you work with Bill to just put some
sure.
language together after the meeting to reflect kind of that point? Yeah, Les?
Mr. Chair, there is one item that in the constitutional language, I'd like to read it, and I have a problem with where the permanent easement falls into. And the part that I have a problem with is under the constitutional language, it says land acquired by fee with money deposited in the Outdoor Heritage Fund under this section must be open to the public taking a fish game during the open season. So, now, where does easement fall in? Does if we're looking at easement to fall under the same restrictions, I think we need an opinion, a legal opinion. If easement falls under this, then we've got a real problem as far as obtaining easements, because very few easements are going to be open to the public at the start. We need to look at a long-range walk-in program, but that's not going to be available in a short-term duration. So where does easement fall in as far as our requirements to be open to the public? An easement is going to be a major part of the expenditures, and it needs to be.
Well, but I think fee is a definition of acquisition of all rights, mm-hmm. versus easement is an acquisition of development rights. So I think the Constitution is very clear. Fee is outright acquisition, where easement is not.
So you're saying, in your opinion, that easement does not fall under the open to the public?
Yeah.
I would go along with that. Hopefully that's the rule here.
Yeah. Any other comments? Otherwise, I'd like to move on. Yeah, Rick, yes.
And on that point with fee, back to bullet point number 4, have documented support from affected local units of government, and maybe Senator Anderson can help me on this, but I think the statute currently on local government approval relates to fee purchase rather than easement. If there's a easement purchase, you don't have to have a local unit, and I would not want to go farther than the statutory requirement there, so that every easement requires a local unit of government. So I would like to amend item 4 that relates that it's only for fee purchase.
Yeah, and we also have already amended it, Rick, just for clarification, when appropriate.
Yep.
And so you want to add to that
when explicit that
when appropriate, have documented support for fee.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Any other comments?
Yeah, I have one more, sort of following up on, I'm not sure this is the right place, but at the LCCMR we got into a rather interesting discussion about forest legacy easements, and the fact that DNR really is a dual agency. It's both responsible for habitat protection and for mineral extraction, and revenues from mineral extraction. And the easements that the DNR wanted to do under Forest Legacy had a loophole that essentially extinguished the easement if they wanted to get minerals underneath it. And the sort of compromise we came up with was that they had to replace what was taken by comparable land on a multiple basis. And I think we used 3-to-1 ultimately. So if you take 100 acres, you've got to find 300 acres of comparable land. This is going to be an issue for Forest Legacy, and I think we ought to deal with it up front in this instead of getting sidetracked with it later. And
Dave, do you have any proposed language?
I'll work with Bill if you'd like me to. If everybody else agrees with me that it's an
Mr.
issue.
Mr. Chairman, in addition to that, I think we need to identify after extraction restoration, put this responsibility on the extraction company.
Okay. I think we're exhausted that section. Let's move on to criteria of requesting organizations. So we have 3 bullets there about we're only going to request or consider requests from organizations that have these 3 minimum standards, our checklist there. Any comments?
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Les.
Along the side of this one, I got a no with 3 explanation points. If you look at item 90 under 97A3B, I can't quote that, but essentially part of the selling point of this bill was to make sure that it was available to the local sportsmen's clubs, the local stakeholders, and if we put these restrictions, like I said earlier, on the local stakeholders, we're going to eliminate about 95% of them. Now, if we funnel this through another agency like Bowser or WCD, yes, they have the capability of meeting these projections. So as a general statement, if we have an organization like our local club, Coots Unlimited, wanted to put together a nice $40,000 project, they couldn't come up with an up-to-date financial statement if you begged them for it. They can't qualify. So we've got to look at what the constitutional language said we need to do, and then what requirements are we going to put on top of that.
Yeah, so Les, just in response to that, we had talked earlier about some qualifying language at the beginning that says this really doesn't apply to the conservation partners per se, that we're going to develop that program. So I suspect, you know, my interpretation is that applies to these three chunks of requirements. So I don't know if that addresses your concern, but it says we may have some different requirements for that program. I mean, we still need accountability, but maybe not at this level for that, for those local sports clubs.
Let's just explicitly add that.
And that's, I think, what Bill was going to do.
Doesn't apply to the that particular...
Under 97A3B.
Yeah, yep. Any other comments? Okay. How about criteria for identifying conservation priorities? We have five bullets there about, of the things that meet this minimum threshold, here are the things we would give the highest priority consideration to, again, for 2009. Any comments, thoughts, suggestions on those?
Mike.
Yeah, Rick.
Item number four on secured matching funds. I think maybe some terminology change might be better there about ability to leverage funds, because you may, matching and leverage are two different things. You might have, matching may mean 50% in one area or 20% or 80%, but you may have multiple sources that come in for the purchase rather than matching. Matching almost implies 50-50. But leveraging means you can get from multiple sources.
So you're suggesting, Rick, ability to leverage funds to supplement.
Yes.
And folks okay with that?
With the ability to match, you may be able to leverage federal dollars. Right. Is that what you're saying there?
Okay. Yeah, Les?
And also, it may be desired to match and leverage the funds. But is it absolutely required? There may be areas that we're going to be addressing that don't have the leveraging capability. So I would say that it's highly desirable, and we should try to always strive to have the matching funds and or leverage funds, but they may not always be available.
Yep. Bill?
I believe that concept is true for all the points in this section.
Yep. Priority.
That's right.
So I'll clarify and believe that that's the case.
Any other thoughts on this last section for the priority consideration, the bullets? These are the ones that we want to hope are raised to the top of the list. Okay. I'm not hearing any objections. Let's go on to page three then, which is obtain public input. And again, this recognizes that, you know, long term we're going to have a more thoughtful process for listening sessions, et cetera. This says that we're going to ask folks to provide us input through a website, through time allotted at each Legacy or Outdoor Heritage Council meeting, and as well as some summaries of listening sessions that we encourage stakeholders to conduct. And Darby, you mentioned the Bowser one, and in fact, our plan is to have Bowser present the summary of those seven listening sessions on Monday. Any language changes or suggestions to number three?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Les?
I did send Bill, when we're looking at the very last one, established website. So far we've been in business a little over a month, and we have yet to issue any type of release to the public, and the lack of information is sometimes worse than bad information. And I think this is a very, very critical point that we're going to have to establish a communication type of facility, website, including distribution to the stakeholders, the citizens of the state of Minnesota. We're going to have a very extensive communication network established for information dissemination and distribution. Otherwise, we're going to continually get in trouble for this. And I would put that establishing of that function as very, very high on the list. We're going to be pressured, and I would like to see a possible job description of that function and start identifying that very, very quickly.
Yeah. Thanks, Les. In fact, you know, Bob, as the chair of the Personnel Committee, I'm sure one of the things you're going to be dealing with is putting together a long-term staffing plan, including the things Les talked about, communication.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Bob?
That's in the incorporated into the position description of the executive director.
I will copy my short notes on it.
Thank you. Any other thoughts on three? Rick?
Going back to the question about public and stakeholders. Mm-hmm. So if you're not an identified stakeholder, how do you provide input? You know, are these public listening sessions? Is it only stakeholder groups that hold listening sessions? Or will there be, we have in the line here about other, that we would be doing some outreach. But should it be public? I just think conduct public listening sessions, or is it just Coutts Incorporated having a listening session for the members of Coutts Incorporated to provide input from Coutts Incorporated on the projects that Coutts Incorporated wants?
So suggestion might be to insert the word public before listening sessions on the second line. Does that get at what you were describing?
Mr. Chairman, just to add to that, I would look at stakeholders being synonymous with individual organizations. If one individual came, I would look at that individual as a stakeholder, and maybe that's where we're cutting hairs there.
I consider myself a specialist.
Well, I just think, the people, individuals who aren't members of organizations might not even come, and unless they're invited in a broad public way. I mean, if it's just an organization sending out a notice to members of that organization, that doesn't really invite members who are, non-members to come. And so I think that's what I'm hearing Rick get at, that we need to, the broader public has an interest in this, and how do we ensure that they're invited, the issues that are discussed represent a broader set of public interests beyond what an organizational interest might be.
So we talked about inserting the word public before listening. So encouraged stakeholders to conduct public listening sessions. What can we do to further that language? Does that do it?
Perhaps in the next section we could add a word or two as well in number four.
Okay.
I'm not sure if there's if we need to add any words. I just want to be really clear about our intent.
Yep. Bill, did you look like you had something?
I think that what we have to do in here very quickly is provide enough substance to allow someone who's reading this to understand how to plug in. I'm not quite sure how to do it. We need to provide enough substance to allow me to take this to the information and education people at DNR and prepare a news release that gets people to the right place at the right time. So any specificity, who, what, when, where, would be very helpful.
Ellen?
And how do we decide who stakeholders are? I mean, if I decide, one of my neighbors decides they want to have a listening session with some other neighbors, does that make them a stakeholder? Or is it by invitation by us that we sort of have a mailing list of stakeholder groups that we invite to do this? What do we mean by that?
Dave, on that point?
I think this is an important point, but I think it sort of falls into the same category as strategic plan. We are not going to have an exhaustive, first we don't have a big staff right now, but we're not going to have an exhaustive process here to have, statewide input in what we do by April 1st. It's just not going to happen. We certainly need to listen and work with the organizations out there that have memberships to make sure that we're hearing that as best we can, but we need a communications plan in the long term that helps us answer these questions of how we listen to the public. We're not going to get there by April 1st.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Les.
In addition to David's thoughts, individual stakeholders, say a landowner that wants to do something with an individual property, his first contact is going to be SWCD. SWCD is a stakeholder, because that individual is not going to get any place unless they funnel that through that type of organization. So I think it does have to apply to the individual, but the individual, if he's got or he or she has that concern, is going to be working through one of the major organized groups, or they probably won't get their request heard. So I would look at the SWCD along with the partnerships that they've arranged to be able to sort and funnel some of these things up in a reduced form to us.
Yeah, Ellen?
Yeah, my question was only, who are we going to invite to do this? How do we, have a
Everybody.
Mailing list? How do we get the word out and to whom? That's all. I'm not suggesting we have to have a meeting in every living room. I agree with you that that's impossible between now and April. I just want to know who we will reach out to ask them to do the stakeholder meetings.
Yeah, Rick?
I think we're already getting, I mean, at least I think Bill's been sending some of these around. I think individually we're also getting people who have, you know, a specific project in mind plus specific themes in mind. I'm sure we're all getting some of those emails. I think the part of the responsibility for the council is to reach those that don't have a way to get that in, and maybe that's that. And I think I brought this up before about having the web page a little interactive, and you do some responsibility where there's an outreach component of getting, you know, by March 1st or by February 15th or something, you know, email us in. We have the technology now where we can take that comment for people who they can't get to a meeting.
Right.
But at 5 a.m. in the morning in their pajamas, they could write a, you know, an email out or something to say, this is the idea that I have on what could work. So we have some net to catch people who are not going to be able to get somewhere else, and that we've done our due diligence of trying to get that in. And I think that can be done with the use of the technology for right now.
I would pledge to do that as soon as possible. We are in the process of launching a new web page. It's a more interactive page, and I will make certain that that has some sort of input facility on it. And I'll read them and send them to you.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Les.
Bill, I've got a very strong concern on the information distribution system that we're going to create. And I think that that information distribution system is going to have to be autonomous to the DNR. I know the DNR's got a website. It's a very extensive, very complicated website, but I think we're going to have an independent distribution system that deals directly to the stakeholders and remains independent. And an example of that website would be sportsmanforchange.org. The website is up and running. It exists, and it's probably our most effective means of communication right now. But I think if we tie it to the DNR website, I think we're going to have some problems. We may run some parallel operations there. But I think we need the autonomous nature of that website attached to the council.
Well, we think you're right.
Okay.
So kind of just pulling back to number three, what we're saying in this is we're encouraging people to hold public meetings, public listening sessions, and give us that input. Whoever, it's not exclusive, it's inclusive. Secondly, we're going to create a website, however, and request people to provide comments there. And third is, at every Heritage Council meeting, we will have a time for public input. And those are the three things for this first go-around that we are going to use as the primary vehicle for getting input. Does that sound okay? Great. We're on to four then. I didn't think it was going to be that challenging to get through seven lines of writing, but number four. Okay, this is really where we are encouraging or asking, requesting the conservation partners or stakeholders, however you want to call them, to organize and convene a process to figure out or to give us their judgments. And, I mean, I will tell you behind the scenes, and I think to one of us, we all know we've been talking to people. They're more than ready to do that. They're waiting. You know, the gate is kind of getting pushed open. They're ready to start running forward and help us out. And what we're doing is formally acknowledging, if you're willing to help us out, we would love that input, because, to be quite honest, that's the way we really need to proceed if we're going to get some good recommendations for the legislature in less than 3 months. So what this says is self-organize, convene, make sure it's open. People are not excluded. It's not just one organization but a series of them. And the first kind of out-of-the-gate start on that process will be on Thursday, as we talked about. There is a meeting of about 70 or 80 folks that are going to be helping us out by breaking into these four areas of wetlands, prairies, forests, and fish habitat systems and trying to identify those priorities. I see that process on Thursday as the first step, and not the only step, but the first step in getting information back to us that says, here's what we think are the highest priority conservation needs, and there's the funding associated with those. So,
Mr. Chairman,
yeah, Les.
The first step I've got is this the right way to organize wetlands, prairies, forests, and fish habitat? Many of the areas that we're going to be aiming at, the major projects, are going to cross all four of these areas, and I think a better organization might be the regional distribution, looking at a major ecological area or geographical diversity area that's going to encompass all these. So I don't know that we can organize by wetlands, because wetlands is going to affect prairies, forestries, and fisheries. Probably not forests as much as fish habitat. So is that really a good way to organize versus geographical, geological?
Mr. Chairman,
yeah, Bob.
To that point on that page 2, criteria for identifying conservation priorities, the first bullet, produce multiple conservation benefits, was one of the priorities that we suggest that we consider, and I think that that addresses Les's point.
Yeah.
We'll give consideration to those that cut across.
That's right. Yeah, Ellen?
Yeah, a couple of other points. I think we should add the word public in here just to be really clear. We could put open, inclusive, public, and collaborative processes.
Good.
And then I just don't understand when habitat became fish habitat.
Mm-hmm.
When did that happen? Or why?
Yeah, that's a great question. And as I looked at the constitutional language, we've got three resource areas clearly defined: prairies, wetlands, and forests. But there's the word fish in there. But if you look at everything else, it talks about habitat for fish, game, and wildlife. Well, game and wildlife fall either in any terrestrial system, wetland, prairies, or forests. I'm not sure if there's any other system there, but then we have to address fish. So I'm open for any suggestions on how to recapture that fish element. I know, Bob, you and I have had some conversations.
Well, I mean, if you want to take really broad definitions, game is wildlife.
Sure.
Fish is wildlife.
Yeah.
In broad definition. So why do you have to say both game and fish? You know, it's
just game habitat.
Wildlife habitat.
Yeah.
Covers everything.
Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Well, but you got it. You got a unique, quirky distinction in that, unlike the other three, fish, it's land and water together. I mean, right. You can't protect or enhance or do anything for fish habitat without dealing with land. And so it does, I see it as a bit separate, a little bit unique from the other three.
Yeah.
For that reason.
Well, and I, Mr. Chair, Darby, you're absolutely right, and I like the idea of focusing on that, so we add the water element and to this. But, you know, I can picture areas of land that are riparian along waterways that don't have any trees left and don't have any prairies left, but they're land, and they're really critical for habitat protection to restore, and they're not fish habitat because the fish never climb up on the shore. And so they wouldn't fall under any of these as far as I can tell. And so it seems like we're narrowing ourselves a little too much. Maybe we should say fish and wildlife habitat, and I'd be happy because then at least we could have all those other critters, the birds or whichever critters, that all the critters that run along the side of the rivers to get their to live their lives, you know, and who rely on those riparian stretches of land for corridors, but that's not just fish that really,
yeah.
Unless they have legs.
No, that's a very good point. So you're suggesting, Ellen, fish and wildlife habitat as that.
That would be a little more.
Yeah.
That would cover your concern, which I think is really important.
I'll just tell you that I know that a number of organizations have contacted me and are ready to go, and they're fish-oriented interests.
That's great.
And that's great. And so as long as we don't lose that,
I'm
fine with this.
I don't want to lose that. I just think it's a little narrow.
Yeah. Other suggestions on 4? That's a good suggestion.
A different point.
Rick?
Under the LOHC, I think we should just ask Minnesotans rather than specific stakeholders. What if the League of Women Voters wants to provide, conduct meetings? Or what if League of Cities or Association of Counties? We just want to ask Minnesotans to organize. We want them to go out and whoever they are, if they're, you know.
Yep.
The South St. Paul Garden Club, they can go out and organize a meeting.
That works
for Minnesota.
Good suggestion. Okay. Other suggestions on 4? About five. So five is after we go through that, and we would spend the month of February listening to these areas, and I think we need to amend five, obviously, fish and wildlife habitat. Ellen, just along your
Thank
point.
You.
But then we would make some allocation of assets from that initial Outdoor Heritage Fund towards these four areas, as well as the Conservation Partners Program, and I heard also a cash flow or reserve account, as well as an emerging issues account. And that would be done after we've heard what those priorities are. And, you know, I think what we don't know right now is what are the shovel-ready projects, to use your term, Bob. I think that's a great term. What are the shovel-ready projects that if money were laid on the table, we could implement?
Again,
where's the attribution pressure coming from, Bob?
Just looking at how we would do this if we were at that stakeholders level, and I think by region, by the different disciplines, do a wetlands proposals across the state, I think it's going to make it very difficult to follow and very hard to organize. I think we have to, again, look at regional definition. But.
Yeah, and, you know, unless just, I know that, as we talked earlier on, everyone, I think, agrees that some regional approach is important. It's a question of can we do that between now and April. But I don't think anyone second-guesses the virtue of doing
it. And I think those requests are going to be coming in by region. So.
Yeah. Okay. Any other comments on five? So the bottom of page three, which is this geographic focus, particularly less the way, you know, the things you've been talking about, talks about the need to distinguish between these unique ecological regions. And maybe there's some language there, Les, that we want to add, saying that, you know, over time or beyond 2009, this will be a more prominent area of our plan or something like that?
Well, we're going to have a strategic plan, and
yeah.
I guarantee you if we're going to do a strategic plan, we're going to have to think about the geography of the state and how we develop the plan. So, I mean, add it if you want, but I think it's almost redundant because we can't do a strategic plan without talking about...
That's right. We'll try and work some language in less, and if you can work with Bill on that, I think it helps just to clarify that, you know, long term we do want to recognize the regional nature of our ecological systems and funding. Yeah, Darby.
But to a degree, those, you know, wetlands, prairies, forests in themselves are strongly linked to regions. I mean, there is the prairie region. And whatever you call it, it's this part of Minnesota. And there are areas where wetlands are huge. They're really significant. There are lots of them. And so it's not like things are just sort of scattered hither and yon. So I really hear what you're saying, but I think that's going to be addressed, actually. I looked through the ecological subsections of the state. 26 different units. Oh my God! There's no way we can organize that. Is there a better way to do it? And it seemed I ended up kind of back with, my gosh, wetlands, prairies, forests, etc. Really do a pretty darn good job of getting at what I think you're concerned about, and certainly what I think others are concerned about. But.
Any other comments on that? And we'll work on some language to try and reflect that regional approach.
I like the last paragraph.
Okay. Do you want to touch it then? Okay, we have some definitions at the end then. Any suggestions on those definitions? Just to clarify those three verbs in the, you know, our interpretation of restore, protect, and enhance.
You know, Mr. Chair,
yeah, Bob?
And David, I was looking at your stuff here. I was thinking that, you know, probably restoration and enhancement, you and this the document that the chair put together are pretty close. The protection thing is one that, where I saw there was probably maybe more discussion needed in that definition. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I wanted to talk about that.
Clarification.
Yeah.
Are you working off David Hartwell's item as well?
Yes, I'm comparing David Hartwell's thoughts from David Hartwell 1229 that UPAP gave to us a couple of days ago.
And it's also in your package here today.
Yeah. And then, so I was trying to compare the two definitions. So for protect, under the document we've been working off of, we say protect is to maintain the ability of habitat to sustain fish, game, or wildlife. David says to support action to preserve natural systems and habitat.
And staff on the Hartwell document recommends that protect be action to maintain the ability of habitat and related natural systems to sustain fish, game, and wildlife.
Okay.
In fact, I would suggest that we take the three definitions in bold on the staff comments about the Hartwell ideas and substitute those all three of them, because I think there's some really important systems ideas.
Darby?
I really agree. I really like how my concern was with David's comment of, or definition of enhance, and I found that really not helpful. I really like the language that says to increase the ability and so forth. So I would support plucking those from your staff and staff comments into the, our official definition.
Let me just make one comment, too, and it relates to restore. It says, with the ultimate goal of restoring pre-European settlement habitat conditions. So 9,000 years ago, Minnesota was entirely forested. 7,000 years ago, about 60 to 70% was prairie. We had prairie running up towards almost Ely. We had oaks and oak savannas up along the North Shore.
Yeah.
So the question is, at what point in time? So I would be really cautious
just
about
the
saying
first human.
Right. There you
just
go.
Just that moment.
The point at which the land surveyors came through and, you know, the Marshner map is the, is
well,
the beginning
bad,
of time.
I think that's what it does say. That's the common definition of pre-European settlement is the Marshner map. And I think this is sort of the way back machine you get into, and you take it as far back as you can. You may not be able to get back to pre-settlement, pre-European, but you can do it the best you can.
Well, I would just say, you know, there's a context piece here that...
I hope that at some point we can have a very... We are so successful that we have a discussion at length about at what point in the past we really have done...
We've altered the
system. Don't we need to go back another 10 million years?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Not to be facetious, but if we look at the initial 97A, the council was... selected for its wide, diverse expertise and extensive knowledge. And is this kind of like explaining fourth grade arithmetic to a bunch of PhDs in mathematics? How far do we have to go in the definition? And do we not all have our individual correct definition of protect, restore, and enhance? So let's. How far do we split the hair on this one?
I think we're good with what the staff's got.
Okay. Then the last page, unless there were other comments.
Dave? A couple of things that were in my suggestions that we haven't talked about. And, again, I'm not sure where to put them, but I feel pretty strongly about both of them. One is just that we should... Maybe not in every single case, but I'd argue in every single case, we shouldn't do restoration on property that doesn't have permanent protection. You know, to fund efforts to restore a prairie at a cost of $4,000 an acre and then see it, you know, in soybeans 3 years later is just ludicrous.
This is just for clarification, folks and members. We're talking about on the bottom of page 2 of your document, the top of page 3. Help me out, Dave.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you.
And I'm very comfortable with what staff suggested, which was to put in a bullet that says restoration and enhancement projects must be limited to resources under permanent public and I'm not sure public protection, but permanent protection of fee ownership or conservation easement agreement.
Mr. Chair, I would highly second that. Because it's we've seen the destruction of the temporary easements of CRP. 400,000 acres are going to be removed from CRP in Minnesota. and the 45-year easement is nothing more than creating a very attractive development corridor in the next at the end of that 45 years. So anything other than permanent easement, I think, is off the table.
So just to clarify, I think, Ellen, to your point, where are we? And what are we talking about modifying? Is it, am I reading into your question? Where are we on this point or not?
Question?
So the question was, we're on the bottom of page 2 of Dave's document, and there were some staff language suggestions on the top of page 3, and I think what people are nodding their heads and saying, incorporating those things.
I do have one small comment on that, and that is where it says easement agreements. I would just say easements.
Should be conservation easements.
Or conservation easements. I mean, that has a clear legal meaning.
Thank you. Yes, good point.
I would just put in conservation easements, and I would strike public protection. They just make it protection. Because if Ducks Unlimited does an easement, it's not public, and we'd be.
Okay. Dave, you had another?
The second one is just we're going to be spending money all over the state, and people are going to be wanting to know what they get for their sales tax. And I think we have to make it absolutely mandatory that where we put money into projects to restore, protect, and enhance, that there is signage that identifies that this money came from this fund, and that it be the obligation of whatever organization or agency we provide funding to has a permanent responsibility to ensure that signage is there. So long after the 25 years, people can wander around the state and know what they invested in and how important it was.
Okay. And, Bill, your suggestion was that maybe something outside this document, but be a statutory?
I don't think it has to be statutory. Well, it could be what we require in our grant agreements. We just can't lose sight of that. I don't care where it goes.
So maybe then, Dave, to your point, back on page 2 of our document, as part of the minimum checklist, that there be some
commitment to
publicizing or whatever.
To put appropriate, I'll work with
Bill. Work with, yep. Okay. Other, are there any others?
Dave, what about the mining issue?
Well, Bill and I are, I think, committed to working on that, aren't we, Bill?
We're committed to working on it. I suggested that we take some time to get in the interests that deal with this on a regular basis and do a little discussion with them offline, perhaps, get some background information that will allow us to bring some choices to the council.
Well, one thing that I've thought about, Dave, is while mining is a unique extraction, there's a lot of things that we extract from the land that I hope we would not limit. Forestry, for example.
No, and that I was talking about digging holes in the ground.
I figured as much, but I want to be sure that we don't go.
No. Forest legacy easements are all about taking timber from time to time.
Mr. Chair, let's make sure that the pendulum doesn't swing too far the other direction. Also, there's a method of conservation. There's a method of exclusion. And we have to look at the economic stability of the state also, and mining is a major portion of that. So we have to use common sense and reality in our restrictions on the mining. And I think the restoration after extraction is very, very critical and a reasonable replacement.
Dave, did you have any others, Dave, or were those?
That's
ones?
It.
Okay, great. Are there any other suggested changes? So what the plan would be is hopefully we can get some formal action by this committee to forward a recommendation of the revised draft that we've talked about today with some additional liberty given to staff, working to massage the language that the council could review and hopefully act upon on Monday.
And the reality of this is it has to be done in the next couple of days.
Yeah. Okay. Ellen.
Sorry, one more thing. I was just looking at David's memo when you talked about parks, and do we need to specifically say that park easements or acquisition for land
is
eligible?
I think this, I have not seen Bill's document, and I think it's covered there. I feel like it is possible under what the criteria that Mike and Bill came up with.
Okay. We have a motion on the table to adopt and forward to the council with a recommendation to approve this process that will be our process for the next 3 months to get us to recommendations by April 1. Any further discussion on the motion?
just to say, Mr. Chair, this is a lot of hard work on your part. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
It's a combined effort. So, Les.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if it's appropriate. Is it wise to ask for any significant or any burning issues from the audience?
Yeah, we could certainly do that. Yeah, if anyone would like to comment. Again, keep in mind that this will be vetted by the full council on Monday, but if there's something that can't wait until Monday.
These are our stakeholders.
That's right. Yes, sir. Please. Could you just introduce who you are?
My name is Brad Cobb, and I just have a question, probably more of a clarification. From the bullet points on page 2, we had quite a bit of discussion on that, but trying to get a government entity or agency to sign off on a project or program in lieu of actually initiating the project, for instance, on fee title, we generally would approach a local government, county board, at the time a purchase agreement is in place, to get them to agree to something in lieu of that or prior to that would be kind of tough. So just keep that in mind when you make your decisions. And then also the identifying in lieu of tax payments, that is a big concern in how to address it and make a project or a program to incorporate that in your initial proposal, especially within, by April 1, it would be pretty challenging. So.
Thank you. Any other comments? Okay. Hi.
Dale Erickson.
Hi, welcome.
Just two quick comments. Number one, in dealing with a number of the processes and the issues you were discussing, the idea of groundwater seemed to be not discussed. It wasn't specifically included, and I think that probably ought to be in there somewhere. And number two, the possibilities for duplication seem to be rather apparent between the lottery money, the LCMR, and these NGOs and whatever it is. And it seems to me that there should be some better distinctions between those kinds of issues.
Great. No, those are very good comments. In fact, we have talked a bit about each of those, and just as a point of clarification, there's an equal amount of money, roughly $80 million for clean water, and I expect that part of that will deal with the groundwater issue. And one of our things that one of our goals is to work with the different partners, whether it be LCCMR or other entities that have jurisdiction over recommending of those other parts of money. So those are things that we're certainly aware of, but thanks for raising those. Gary?
I had Gary Leaf. I just had a couple comments on a couple of items that I was looking at on here. One of them pertains to some of the language that's in the constitutional piece. One of the critical parts we put in there was regarding gain. That went through the legislative process, and there was actually considerable debate about why that term was needed. Minnesota is a constitutionally protected right to hunt and fish state. It's got a very strong tradition. Game essentially means two things broadly. It means small game. That's what the Department of Natural Resources and big game. The second reference to game, there's really two specific mentions of hunting. Obviously, if they're regulating small game, that's different than wildlife. If they're regulating big game, that's different than wildlife, and so on. The second reference, of course, is regarding access, regarding on the any land that's acquired by acquisition must be, not might be, it must be open to the public taking of open to the hunting and so on and so forth. The problem that's going to happen on easements is the same problem that happens with the most successful conservation program in the United States, CRP. CRP is construed by a lot of hunters and anglers as setting up private refuges. The easements go out, it's put on land. You have this debate all the time. the government's paying for it. So as a remedy, you're seeing on the most successful conservation program in the United States, the combining of conservation easements that also includes access. As CRP announced that, I believe, in 21 states, the Department of Natural Resources was commissioned, I believe, a year or two ago to put together a walk-in access program. Nebraska is probably the furthest along with regard to that, where they have are combining habitat with hunting and fishing opportunity. And the term game ties into it with regard to small game, big game. Also, too, that the directive that the rule is open a hunting and fishing exception, it would be that it's not. But, you know, so if there was a way to provide easements that were consistent with the constitutional intent that it's open to the public, that provides the habitat benefits, that provides the public access, because that's going to be a problem. When people start hearing about different habitat opportunities, public input's going to be critical. But, boy, not being able to access certain lands, that's going to be a big deal.
So, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Bob.
Gary, thanks. So I think what you're saying is that wherever possible, we ought to allow access.
I think that the priority should be one, access, and then, by acquisition, that's clearly defined there. And second, the second best point is easements that provide access and so on, if that can be done. And that's going to create
easements. Right. So, Mr. Chair, I wonder if we ought to consider, and somewhere in our document here, to place a value, a higher value or a relative value on easements that allow access for taking of game.
Well, if that was to be the case, we certainly could put it at the bottom of page 2 under criteria for identifying priorities. And I think that's what Gary is referring to.
It may not be a requirement, but it's that has a relative value.
So could you just restate it? I mean, Bill will capture the essence, but could you restate that so everyone is clear what you're talking about as an added bullet?
Would you like for me to?
Yeah, you'll figure it out.
Okay.
Wherever
Mr. Chair. Ellen, and then.
Oh, I just wanted to be clear. You're talking about the priority section to easements that allow public access.
Yes.
And then I think as long as we're gonna do that, we should give priority to access for other purposes beyond hunting and fishing. So public access in general.
Just public access.
Yeah, for whatever purpose.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Unless
Gary and continuation with your thought. CRP has been a very successful program, but is fast deteriorating because of the non-permanency of it. It's always been a conflict, and it's always been a question between the private landowners that are doing the restoration, protection, and preservation versus the access of the public. It's a continual discussion that happens all around the state. And I think we need to, in our long-range plan, short, long, medium-range planning, try to establish the walk-in type of principles like the PLOTS programs in Dakota. Whole different geological situation, whole different situations. But I think we can do a similar program in Minnesota, which would be very beneficial to the landowner. But sometimes there's going to be easements that are very critical that are going to follow in conjunction with the clean waters to preserve and protect along the waterways and so forth. So I don't think we want to cut those out totally because we, by not having walk-in, we're not having public access, we may still want to do that easement for the overall protection of restoration, protection, and preservation.
Yeah, the one thing I was going to ask on that is exactly the delineation between the Clean Water Fund, which is charged with protect, restore, and enhance water quality in lakes, rivers, and streams, whereas there might be easements under that purpose, whereas the charge here constitutionally is protect, restore, and enhance wetlands, prairies, and forests and habitat for fish, game, and wildlife. You know, there's the lakes, rivers, and streams. The easements over there, some of the easements coming forward might be more congenial over on that side of it rather than over on this particular side. The legislature, in its wisdom, put these things in absolute, I define it like a mutual fund. They're separate mutual funds with separate intentions. The intent here has historically you know, has always been hunting and fishing and so on and so forth. That's been, you know, pretty clear. But we may have unintended conservation benefits by doing a habitat project, whereas water clearly is to improve water quality, but it may have unintentional benefits of helping fishing, something like that.
Dave, and then Rick.
Yeah, I don't have any problem with putting as a one of our points public access, but I do have to say we've got to be very careful as we go down there, because there are many landowners who won't do an easement if it involves public access. If we're talking about acquisition of easements, you're talking about a totally different scale in terms of the cost.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
It will cost almost as much as buying the property to buy public access and extinguish development rights as it does. It's fine as a goal, but it shouldn't be a prerequisite, because there are many cases where it's important to protect the land but not have public access at the same time.
Rick?
The legislature could have set public access on easements, but we limited it to the fee title purchase. And so I think I agree with what David said, that in the short term, if there are special projects that you want to get, you are probably going to need to not require the public access here in the beginning, because you won't get the land.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, in
direct response to that, Bob, because I know
yes.
less than...
I think that in a case where we have all things being equal, and two projects, if all things are otherwise equal, so conservation value and so forth and so on, giving preference to the project that had public access, where the other one didn't, would be how I'd score.
And that's the intent.
Not to open up the Pandora's box here, but Gary's asked the question, I've asked the question, and I guess this would be a question posed to our legislators, is who is going to who and how is going to administer the Clean Waters account?
Well, Mr. Chair, by law, the legislature. There is a Clean Water Council, but they're by law not, they don't oversee the legacy dollars. They oversee traditional clean water funding or make recommendations on it. So we're going to establish some working groups or subcommittees or some levels of oversight that allow for particular attention to it as well as public input, and that has yet to be determined.
Ellen, are you comfortable with the progress?
Yeah, it's getting there. I think I'll probably be proposing something soon.
Gary?
The only other one I had was regarding, that I can follow right now, I made notes on, was regarding the transfers. That's creating quite a problem right now, because there's wildlife management areas where Botanicore and those are being sold off by a bill that was established in 2005, and that's creating the impression for this council that he's going to go through the process, set up habitat projects and so on, and then at some point be sold. So I think that there needs to be, with regard to transfer, some provisions in there that says, one, that it's going to retain, hunting and fishing opportunities on those lands where it definitely applies, but second, that if it, there's ever any change, it's got to be replaced with something of greater or equal value or something like that. The parallel... what's going on right now with some of the DNR selling of WMA. Right.
And just on that point, Bill's going to be working, I think, with Dave to get some language to that effect.
Yeah. That's creating a lot of confusion out there, let's put it that way.
Thanks, Gary.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any other comments? If not, yes, sir, please. Could you introduce who you are?
Nick Quaid.
Hi, welcome.
I was just overhearing the language of the conversation, and I heard Mr. Hartwell talking about looking at existing grant programs and et cetera, organizations out there that already dwell into certain areas. And also I heard language talking about looking at long-term outlook and et cetera. And I was reading the constitutional amendment, and the one language in the amendment that I seem to keep going through my head is the dedicated money under this section must supplement traditional sources of funding for these purposes and may not be used as a substitute. And I'm sitting there and I'm debating and going through my mind, okay, the definition of supplement and the definition of substitute. And I'm sitting here thinking to myself, well, I was just at the, a couple weeks ago, the Finance Committee meeting, and then before that, the Ways and Means Committee on the economic outlook. And the most sickly person in the room seemed to be the chief economist, because the first sentence that he said before the committee meeting was, all of this presentation is completely thrown out the window now because we don't know what sort of territory we're entering into. And I was recently elected to a position, conservation district, and as I'm beginning to dwell into how the funding of different organizations that deal with the environment already, I'm looking at it all and thinking to myself, there's a lot of organizations out there now that are going to simply put, have huge funding and budgetary problems coming down the trough. There's a lot of organizations that, for example, are, you know, dependent upon or blowing through their reserves and et cetera. So now I'm sitting here thinking to myself, looking at this language, well, I'm like, well, because of a specific economic challenge, what constitutes supplement, what constitutes substitute? And I just didn't hear any discussion amongst all of you as to the definitions of those two, being as though we're looking at uncharted economic territories down the line, plus the limited time limit we have, or that you have, looking down the trough here and coming up with, like you had stated before, Mr. Chairman, you know, what are the projects that have the shovel ready to go? So, and I didn't know where we're at when it comes to that, and I didn't know what the criteria were for the definition between supplement and substitute, especially, like I said, when we're facing economic times we haven't seen in generations. So.
Oh, great. Thanks for the comment. Yeah, thank you. Any other comments?
Can I try to answer?
You want to try? Go ahead. Rick?
I'll use an example. If you're a soil and water conservation district supervisor, you may receive, say, $20,000 to your district from the Board of Water and Soil Resources as a general service grant. Let's say we, Ellen and I, decide that we're in committees, we're going to push forward that we're going to eliminate that general services grant, and we take David's recommendation that we take the lottery or the constitutional money and say we will fund a general services grant with the constitutional language. That would be substitution.
That would be okay. Thank you. Any other comments?
And I get blamed for that.
Okay. We have a motion on the table. Any further discussion on the motion to adopt and rep forward for with a recommendation that the council approve this document as our process for the next 3 months? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Motion to adjourn. Moving too fast. Rick.
And I apologize. I was over in Minneapolis and I couldn't get over here fast enough. So I don't know if you talked about the issue of Legislative Coordinating Commission and some acknowledgement of the reality of how we're operating now in some memorialization or documentation. Did you mention?
No, in fact, Bob will be making a report of the Personnel Committee on Monday, and we'll have a discussion of that issue then.
Yeah, thank you.
Motion to adjourn. We have a motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Thank you very much. So we